Former U.S. Senator Arlen Specter died on Sunday. This hour, we spend a few minutes with his former Senate colleague, Charles Grassley, to reflect on Specter's long political career. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Senator Grassley is a ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and served on that committee with Arlen Specter for a number of years. After talking with Senator Grassley, the case of a UI law school graduate who says she was passed over for jobs at the UI because of her conservative political views. Then we'll hear about a new Des Moines Register series that looks at the living conditions of Iowa's kids. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We learned in the news that former U.S. Senator Arlen Specter died on Sunday after a long battle with cancer. The veteran Pennsylvania politician had overcome numerous serious illnesses over the past two decades, including a brain tumor. He'd been in the public eye for a very long time, ever since serving as a member of the Warren Commission, the commission which investigated the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Specter was elected to the Senate in 1980 and represented Pennsylvania for 30 years. That's longer than anyone in that state's history. Joining us now for a few minutes to reflect on Senator Specter's life and long political career, Iowa's Republican U.S. Senator Charles Grassley. Senator Grassley is the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee and served on the committee with Senator Specter for a number of years. Good afternoon to you, Senator.
Good afternoon. I'm very glad to be with you and very sorrowful for the passing of Senator Specter and my condolences to family and friends.
What will you remember most about Arlen Specter?
Very, very good lawyer, although my dealing with him wasn't necessarily in the law like in the courtroom. But he had vast knowledge of the law. And the other thing that I would remember is that he was Republican 99% of his life, and he was very independent and represented the people of Pennsylvania very well, because it's a very diverse state, from rural areas that are very conservative to Pittsburgh and to Philadelphia that tend to be more liberal.
You mentioned Specter's independent streak. He was always proud of what he called his independent voice, and he was unafraid to buck his party on certain issues and unapologetic when he decided in 2009 to switch his party affiliation to the Democratic Party. Here's a bit of tape from him. He's here in 2009 at a White House press conference accepting the backing of President Obama and Vice President Biden.
I was unwilling to subject my 29-year record in the United States Senate to the Pennsylvania Republican primary electorate, but I am pleased to run in the primary on the Democratic ticket, and am ready, willing, and anxious to take on all comers in a general election. I have not represented the Republican Party. I have represented the people of Pennsylvania, and I will continue to do just that.
Arlen Specter in 2009 at a White House press conference. Senator Grassley, how did you view this switch by Senator Specter?
Well, I came to the Senate with Senator Specter, and that was a year after the Reagan landslide, and there were 18 new senators, which is a lot of new senators, and 16 of those 18 were Republicans, and he and I came together, and I served with him that entire 30 years on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And at the time that he made that announcement that he was going to change his Democrat, I felt sorrowful. But, he was man enough to come to the Republican caucus at that very time to ask for just a few minutes of why he was changing parties. And he laid it out in a very practical manner that he knew that he was subject to Republican primary opposition, and he felt it was very strong, and he felt that he had a better chance to continue representing the people of Pennsylvania as a Democrat than as a Republican, and that he could be elected as a Democrat, which, of course, he wasn't, but he felt that that was the best chance. And so I think what he was, it's another demonstration that he was putting the people of Pennsylvania above partisan politics.
Senator Spector embodied a vanishing breed of liberal republicanism before that switch to the Democratic Party late in the twilight of his political career. I wonder, Senator Grassley, what are your thoughts on that switch and the what that switch says, the course of his political career at the very end? What does it say about politics in this country and how they've changed in the past three decades?
Well, I think the Democratic Party and the membership of the Senate has become more liberal, and the Republican caucus and its membership has become more conservative. And I think that that's a division you see at the grassroots of America that is, and you even see it in this presidential election where, you know, 48 or 49% of the people know they're back in Romney and the same number back in Obama, and very few people to make up their minds.
Mm-hmm. So
yet.
Are you saying that there's really, with our increasingly partisan and divided Senate, that there's really not any room for the kind of independence and willingness to work across both sides of the aisle?
Well, I think that it's exaggerated to some extent by the fact that controversy makes news. You know, you folks in journalism know that better than I do. But I always say to people that ask the very same question you just asked me at my town meetings here in Iowa, I answer it first as I did you, and then I went on to say that nothing in the United States Senate gets done if you don't have some bipartisanship when it takes 60 votes and you only have 53 Democrats and 47 Republicans right now. So I think it's exaggerated, but yet it is more divided than it has been in the years that I've been in politics.
I know we have just a couple minutes before you need to leave, Senator. How close were you to Senator Spector?
Well, on a personal basis, I wouldn't say that, you know, no senator is really bosom buddies of other senators like they used to be 50 years ago when we didn't have airplanes and fly home. But I considered him a person that I could always go to, and I felt like he could always come to me to discuss how we could work together and how we could help each other. And I would say one of the best compliments I've ever had paid to me, and you could probably go to the Congressional Record online and type in Grassley and type in Harry S. Truman and type in Spector, and you'd see that he made the best compliment I've ever had given to me, that I was very much like Harry S. Truman in the sense that I was independent, a populist, and grounded in well-grounded in my constituency.
Senator Grassley, in the minute we have remaining, do you have a favorite story, a personal story to share about Arlen Spector?
Yeah, Arlen Spector was picked by the Republicans because we only had one person to ask questions of Clarence Thomas and the other hearings during that hearing. And I sat right beside Arlen Spector, and I only made a two or three sentence statement about the hearing, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but never said anything else because Arlen Spector was doing all the questioning for the 8 or 9 Republicans. And because he was asking the tough questions of the professor that was accusing Clarence Thomas.
Hill. Anita Hill, correct?
Yeah, Anita Hill. Thank you for reminding me. Anyway, he asked tough questions of Anita Hill, and I was sitting there right beside him. And everybody, when I'd go around my state, even though I was well-known in my state, they were telling me how mean I was to Anita Hill, and I didn't ask any questions of her. And it was because he was doing the tough questioning that I think had a great deal to do with Clarence Thomas's approval for the Supreme Court.
Okay, Senator Grassley, we know you're on a tight schedule, and we do appreciate very much you joining us for a few minutes at the beginning of our program to reflect on the life of former U.S. Senator Arlen Spector. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Teresa Wagner was praised by colleagues as smart, friendly, and passionate about the law. She was a leading candidate when two jobs came open to teach writing at the University of Iowa Law School. She was, after all, a graduate of the University of Iowa and already working part-time at its writing center, and she had received positive reviews from students and a key committee. But after she interviewed with the faculty in 2007, one of those jobs went to someone without teaching experience and the other wasn't filled. She was passed over for other jobs in the coming years. Teresa Wagner says she was blackballed because of her legal work against abortion rights and taking her complaint to a jury this week. She's taking her complaint to a jury this week in federal court in Davenport. And it's a case that's being closely watched in higher education because of longstanding allegations of political bias at left-leaning law schools. Wagner's case is considered to be the first of its kind. And joining us to discuss it, Walter Olson, senior fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies. His latest book, Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia and an Over-Lawyered America. He's also the founder of overlawyered.com, often cited as one of the oldest blogs on law. Good afternoon to you, Walter Olson.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Is it surprising that a charge of liberal bias would be leveled at a public university law school?
Well, in one way it's not surprising because the big and prestigious law schools are overwhelmingly liberal. There was a Georgetown Law Journal study in 2005 that found that at Stanford, Yale, and Harvard, respectively, 94%, 92%, and 91% of the faculty's contributions went to Democrats as opposed to Republicans. But it is kind of unusual that someone would sue over it, and that's what makes this case unusual and widely watched, because it's been thought by, whether you like the trend or not, it's been thought that this is just the way things are, and now we will find out whether it violates the law in some way. This is assuming that she proves her case. Mm-hmm. Whether a law school, and in particular a state law school, is under a legal obligation not to let politics get in the way of hiring in an area of law where it's hard to keep politics out of everything. Lots and lots of legal issues are politically charged.
I wonder, based on the statistics that you just mentioned there, and this being a rare case, this has existed for many years, this charge of bias, and when you look at it, the statistics behind it at least back up the fact that faculty in public university law schools are largely Democratic. Why would this have happened now? Why not earlier?
Well, her lawyers are offering what's better, more specific evidence than there usually would be on the record. There are a number of reasons why people don't sue. For one thing, they may think I'll be unemployable if I get a reputation as someone who sues at a law school. You know, what other one will take me? But beyond that, the deliberations usually never wind up being on the public record or otherwise accessible to you. Now, Teresa Wagner's lawyers actually have a memo from one of the officials at the law school saying, I'm kind of worried about this one because everyone hates her politics. I mean, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it was just about that bald. And although there's always complication in a paper trail, and the author of that memo says that he doesn't think that politics actually sank her candidacy, and you can find other pieces of evidence, and indeed the law school, as it puts on its defense, is going to say she had an interview that didn't go well and so forth. I think one of the things that propelled this into court is just that she actually had some documentation in a way that a lot of candidates never get.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Away from this individual case, to the larger picture, some will say we can attribute the overwhelming number of liberal law faculty to a difference in career choice. Explain what is meant by that and whether you think that's a valid argument.
I think there's some validity, but it doesn't explain it all. And what's meant by that argument is people with sterling legal credentials are in a lot of demand. They can get hired by a law firm in many cases to make a ton of money representing clients. At the same time, if they want to go into legal academia, odds are they're going to make less money. They're going to have a different lifestyle, which is not as crazy in the demands it places on them, but is also you know, going to give other types of satisfactions. And the argument is the conservatives are more likely to go off and have a regular career with a law firm, and somehow or other the atmosphere of academia is more appealing to liberals. Now, as someone who is more on the right politically myself, I agree, you know, there's something to that, but not enough to find 96-4, frankly.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think a more liberal faculty has as far as implications for the education of future attorneys or the law profession itself.
Well, let me start by saying that most professors really believe in being fair, and they try hard to be fair. And many of them will just watch themselves to make sure that they're not giving lower grades or a harder time in class to someone who disagrees with their politics. That having been said, there's several very important consequences when you've got a politically lopsided or uniform tone at the faculty. And one of them is some questions just never get raised at all, because if you aren't coming from a particular viewpoint, you don't see some questions as important, you don't ask certain types of questions. For all the goodwill in the world, you know, you just don't see past your own assumptions sometimes. And that's a part of the educational problem in it. There's also a problem for public policy, because almost everyone turns to legal academia for answers on a lot of tough questions. You know, how should we interpret the Constitution? What on earth is the Supreme Court up to this year? These are questions where, whatever your viewpoint, you will probably, if you're doing a story on it in the press, you will probably wind up talking to some law professors. And when they are coming at it overwhelmingly from one point of view, I mentioned the Supreme Court. Legal academia is actually surprisingly bad at predicting what the Supreme Court will do. And
right.
Viewpoint is so different. You know, there are so few people teaching constitutional law who understand how Scalia's mind works or how Alito's or Roberts' minds works in the way that they do understand how Ruth Ginsburg's or Elena Kagan's works.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if this would be in favor of, for instance, public universities having someone look over their shoulder, given these implications, to make sure there's not only a diversity of, well, other things, but of opinion, of political perspective.
Well, here's where I part company from some of my fellow thinkers, because I've spent a lot of my career looking at litigation, which is very destructive, very expensive, very random process. And I am afraid that if the courts get into this area, even though there's some constitutional grounds, even though, in theory, a public law school should be just as politically unbiased as a Department of Motor Vehicles. You know, Department of Motor Vehicles should not be turning down an employee because of their politics. And by the same logic, you can argue that a law school shouldn't either. But what if everything can be taken to a judge? Then you've got to worry about the judge's politics, about the judge's own biases. You've got to worry. I tell my conservative friends, this time it's a conservative suing. Next time, maybe it's an extreme left-winger suing. You know, whatever rule they set, you've got to be willing to live with. And universities work better when there's collegiality on the faculty. If they were asking me, I would say, don't invite the judges in. Try to improve peer review. Try to Harvard had a diversity committee, a faculty diversity committee for 30 years, over which time it did not hire any Republicans. I wasn't asking all the right diversity questions, but I think peer review and collegiality is the better way to try to get this sort of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you see there could be an improvement there. That would be the mechanism. But litigation is, in your opinion, not the medic.
I'd love to see it come from within. I'm much more frightened of seeing it come from outside.
Let's talk a little bit more about this case of Teresa Wagner. Now, it's just started today at federal court in Davenport. Her complaint is being heard. A jury will listen to it. What are the possible outcomes?
Well, this case has been in litigation for years. Originally, a court dismissed it on summary judgment, and then the Eighth Circuit said, no, she's presented enough evidence. You've got to let a jury hear it. As in any jury trial, there's a range from they're completely siding with her, and I'm not sure whether her lawyers are asking just for money, but the employment law in general allows them to ask for in statement in a job. Likewise, the university, I would think, would be more frightened, unless the dollar amounts are very large. They're more frightened of a court order saying you must employ someone than they would be of saying, look, she had to earn less somewhere else, please pay the difference. She's making a point here. I don't think that from the press coverage of it, it doesn't seem like it's a case that's mostly driven by, I missed out on some money and I'd like that. She wants to make a point, and in making that point, the university must be nervous about the difference between a narrow ruling and a broad ruling. A narrow ruling is, you know, this ticket, this ride, you know, we don't find the process was done adequately in her case, and we're not going to say too much about what should happen in the future, except you've got to take a closer look. A broad one would be, universities have been ignoring their responsibility, or public universities, because there's a big difference here between state and private. State universities have been ignoring a constitutional obligation to be politically neutral in faculty hiring, and then this must end. You know, that kind of language from the court would cause, if not coronaries, then at least gasping around the country.
Mm. So let's take the instance where the jury sides completely with Teresa Wagner's case. How would you predict that would change hiring procedures not only at the University of Iowa Law School but across the country?
The principle is very much one that's not limited to Iowa, because there is constitutional precedent on when the government can take into account politics. So this is definitely a nationwide case. They will be looking carefully. If it looks as if her win was narrow and just because she was able to bring in much stronger evidence than most litigants will, then less of a shockwave. If, on the other hand, they look at that situation and they say, we've turned down candidates pretty much the same way through someone blackballing them because they thought they wouldn't fit in politically, at that point, they've got a lot of questions to ask.
Finally, before we have to go here in less than a minute, what is this due to, regardless of the outcome, Teresa Wagner's employability? You talked before about the fear. Perhaps this is so rare because academics would fear for their employability in the future. What does this do for her?
Well, she had gotten an offer from a religious conservative law school, and that's, in a way, part of her point is that her views were such that she was going to be confined to that ghetto of legal academia, and I don't know what her priorities are, whether she wants to stay in the state, whether she would consider going to a different institution or whatever, but she made a pretty good case that she had tried to meet them halfway, and on being turned down the first time, it applied for other sorts of positions. Legal writing is one where someone who's got talent in legal writing can also probably find jobs outside legal academia, okay, because more than lawyers ever need good writing.
Walter Olson, we have to go. Thank you very much. Senior fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies, Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia and an Over-Lawyered America, his latest book. Walter Olson, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And when we come back in just a moment, we'll talk with Carol Hunter of the Des Moines Register. They've started a new series on the living conditions of Iowa kids. And then we'll also talk with Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio. He's been covering the ground game of politics 3 weeks before Election Day. Those to come when we get back here on River to River. This is Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time on the program, the 2012 World Food Prize laureate, Daniel Hillel, joins the program to talk about his role bringing advanced irrigation techniques to crops in arid and dry regions in the Middle East. Hillel has impacted farming lands in more than 30 countries with his technique of micro-irrigation. That's a type of irrigation that keeps the soil continuously moist without overusing the water supply. Hillel will present a lecture on his work tonight at Iowa State University at 8 p.m. He'll be joining us tomorrow at this time in our Des Moines studio. Today, the Des Moines Register has started a new series on the living conditions of Iowa kids, and here to talk for a few minutes with us about it, Carol Hunter, Senior News Director at the Des Moines Register. Carol, hi.
Hello.
Why did you think this was a good time to focus on the living conditions of Iowa's kids?
Well, through our reporting, a number of factors started coming on our radar about how trends were affecting Iowa kids, and it seemed the right time to take a deeper dive and really look at what was affecting their lives, and we found some pretty disturbing things.
Mm-hmm. Iowa ranks 13th in the nation for child poverty, and it's not very high, but the report mentions that you made some disturbing trends. What are some of the trends you locked in on?
Well, one is that while our poverty rate is relatively good compared to the rest of the nation, the increase in our poverty rate has outpaced the nation in three of the four past decades. So we're getting worse at a faster pace. Plus, long-term trends are really driving this. One is a steep increase in single-parent families in Iowa. About one in three kids is being raised in the home by a single parent. And unfortunately, with only a single income, that puts about a third of all single-parent families under the federal poverty level. Also, as a whole, Iowa has seen a flattening of incomes over the past four decades or so, something the nation has experienced as well. And then also, low-skill workers have a very difficult time moving up the chain, so to speak, and getting better jobs. We've seen that one in four workers earn so little in Iowa, less than about $10.50, that it does not support a family of four. Theoretically, a mother and father and two children does not keep them above the poverty level.
In the article that you have out today, you described the Talon family, if that's the correct pronunciation of their family name, what they're living like. Describe that. Tell us a little bit about the family you focused on.
Well, Talon is a 22-month-old. His parents are, his last name is Talon Blackford.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Blackford and Josie Zygmunt. Now, these are natives of Iowa, went through Iowa school systems. His father, Stephen, dropped out of school, doesn't have a high school degree. His mom did get her high school degree through an alternative school, but both of them had struggled in school. And now they moved to the metro area, really thinking about their son and thinking about good schools. They particularly had learned about West Des Moines and thinking this would be a good school system for our son to attend. But the father, the best work he's attained at this point is as a cook at a restaurant, cooking chicken and French fries. And his mom, Josie, hasn't been able to find any kind of permanent work. She cleans motel rooms, and she'll serve concessions, you know, on a spot basis. Basically, whatever labor she can scrounge up. But it's certainly not enough to really put a roof over their heads or to keep food on the table regularly.
Mm-hmm.
They're doubling up with another family that they met at a homeless shelter right now.
Mm. Was Talon's family pretty easy to find or challenging? How common is it?
Unfortunately, I think it's common that families are struggling. While only about 15% of kids live in families under the federal poverty level, research shows that that's a fairly low level, and that about 200% of the poverty level is what a lot of experts say that families need to really be able to, you know, pay the rent on time, put food on the table, pay their utilities, and not always being behind in their bills. And when you look at it that way, it gets up to be about 36% of all kids in Iowa live in families that are kind of struggling to make ends meet. Now, from a reporting perspective, it becomes somewhat difficult to find families who want to tell their stories because these families, almost all of them are working. We talked to seven different families that we featured in the reporting, and at least one person is working, or in one case it's a grandmother who retired after a long career as a public worker. So it's not that they're not working. They're just struggling with low-wage jobs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it takes bravery to really talk about your situation with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I imagine that would be the other reason they're working. And also, it's not a particular, you're not particularly proud of your situation if you find yourself in it.
Uniformly, these families talked about wanting to make sure that their kids stayed in school. They want better for their kids than what their kids and they are, the situations they're in right now.
Carol Hunter, Senior News Director of the Des Moines Register, talking about a new Des Moines Register series, talking about the living conditions of Iowa kids. In this first article, Carol, the Des Moines Register points out that more kids, Iowa kids, lived in distressed areas. And in Des Moines, you point to seven neighborhoods showing extreme poverty. Now, does the segregation of neighborhoods coincide with the boundaries of school zones?
Not necessarily. It really does sort of come down to neighborhoods, and some neighborhoods are split between schools and some are not.
Mm-hmm.
This is based on some census tract research that has been done by a group here in Des Moines.
Catch your breath there, Carol. Carol is a senior news director at the Des Moines Register. Des Moines Register starting a new series on the living conditions of Iowa kids. Yeah, go ahead. I guess what I was getting at is on this program we've talked about neighborhoods and cities sorting themselves out into political classes and socioeconomic classes. I wonder if that's evident that we are increasingly wanting to be with our socioeconomic class.
excuse me, I am. I'm having a little trouble with allergies today.
Okay.
We did find that phenomenon as well.
Okay. In the article you had today, the Greater Des Moines Partnership's Capital Crossroads Initiative was pointed out has a 5-year plan for 10 Des Moines neighborhoods where the median income is around $28,000 annually. That's compared to around $55,000. For the metro area, and a quarter of the 26,000 residents who live in these areas have dropped out of school. Now, someone quoted in the article today in the Des Moines Register who grew up in one of these neighborhoods said that it's hard to go into the metro area that is so unwelcoming, so it's easier to stay isolated as someone in poverty. I wonder if you or your staff, others have, could describe more what is meant by that term unwelcoming. What actually happens?
I think it comes down to how people are raised and mindset and also just what they see around them. If you're a child who has grown up in a neighborhood where everyone is poor and you rarely get to go to the zoo or get to go to the park or the state fairgrounds or things like that, going out of your neighborhood becomes something of a much bigger deal than it would be for another child. It does become very self-reinforcing, the isolation. If your parents don't make many trips outside of the area, the very neighborhood where you live for work or school or that sort of thing, you just don't think about leaving that neighborhood. So it becomes very self-limiting, we're told.
Mm-hmm. Your article today in the Des Moines Register begins with a quote from a high school student saying that many students drop out of school to have babies. But you don't go in the article to mention any efforts to decrease teen pregnancy. I wonder, is it sexual education lacking in these areas? And is that perhaps a topic an awareness that needs to be raised in these communities?
Well, one thing that we will certainly be doing is looking at trends like teen pregnancy. That actually is one of the ways that Iowa has done better, and the whole nation, that there has been a reduction in teen pregnancies. So that trend line is looking better. You can see overall that this phenomenon of women giving birth to babies without being married, and then having to try to sustain a lifestyle for that child with a single income, really does affect many more families than it did a generation ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the phenomena that we're going to look at in subsequent days, in subsequent months of the series. Some people say we really have to look at the entire institution of marriage as a state and as a nation. Obviously, that's kind of a controversial topic, but it's something that we editors and reporters who have really studied this data think it's time to have that conversation.
I wonder, through the research that you've done, the reporting at the Des Moines Register, how much of this looks to be the product of globalization, the fact that there's a limited amount of manufacturing jobs in Iowa?
That is certainly a factor. We have seen such a flattening of wages. So many people are not qualified for more than service sector jobs serving at fast food restaurants, that sort of thing. Being a certified nursing assistant at a nursing home, very necessary jobs, but they don't pay very well. It used to be that many, many families were sustained by that good manufacturing job that paid $15, $20 an hour, and there are fewer of those now.
Are any hints as to what could be done, since that is one of the factors, what can be done to tackle that, a remedy for that?
Well, so many people would say that it comes back down to education, because people have to be ready to take the jobs that the economy needs. And, we have some stats in here that some estimates that 3 out of every 5 jobs within a decade or so are going to require some kind of post-secondary education. So the first step is to get kids graduated high school, and then it's to get further education beyond that. So whether it's an advanced manufacturing job or an information technology job, other jobs that are going to pay better to make sure that our kids are ready for those jobs.
Mm-hmm. Carol Hunter, before we have to go, when will the next article be in this series? And what will its focus be?
This coming Sunday, we're going to look at hunger among children in Iowa. And then they're going to roll out about once a month, and we're going to look at the gamut of children's issues, mental and physical health, the difficulty people have in finding good child care, the trying to get kids off at a good start as far as reading skills. Lots of issues. We'll be looking at this all year.
Carol Hunter, Senior News Director at the Des Moines Register, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the Des Moines Register's new series. Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, if you've been to a Mitt Romney rally, there's a good chance you heard this song by Kid Rock. Finally today, we check in with Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, talk a little bit about the political ground game going on in the state. What do we have, Clay? 3 weeks before Election Day.
That's right, Ben.
And you've been to plenty of these political rallies, and you've heard the Kid Rock song. We're going to hear, we're not going to give it away at this point, the musical backdrop for President Obama as well. Candidates often seek to paint a picture of their campaigns with this music, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. And Kid Rock, that song "Born Free," it's like you mentioned, at every single one of these Romney or Ryan rallies, you can always put money on the fact that, okay, he's getting a little more excited. The crowd's cheering. We're going to hear Kid Rock in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You were Mitt Romney was campaigning in Iowa last week, and you were there. What can you tell us about the event?
Yeah, he took stage on a family farm that was just west of Des Moines near Van Meter. Freshly harvested corn crops were the parking lot for the event, in front of a barn with a giant Romney Ryan sign. There was a John Deere tractor with that trademark red, white, and blue R. He spent about 15 minutes talking about agriculture policy and then telling some personal stories.
Mm-hmm. Did we learn anything new about his agriculture policy in that appearance?
Really, it was Romney's economic plans, but through the eye of agriculture. Brought up the estate tax or the death tax. Talked about scaling back regulation, which is something that a lot of the farmers or small business people that I've talked with at these rallies are really pointing at as their number one issue, as well as lowering taxes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you've noticed in covering Mitt Romney or perhaps Paul Ryan, since Mitt Romney's perceived win in the first debate, if you've seen any changes, if you saw a change in this stop, for instance, larger crowds, more enthusiasm, a different tone.
Crowds were still pretty much the same. I mean, there were the level that I'd kind of seen at the other rallies I'd been to. But the one thing that was really different to me about this rally than ones that I'd covered earlier on in the campaign season was this personal side of Mitt Romney. He told a couple stories, one about a 14-year-old boy who was had leukemia, that when he was volunteering for his church, that he kind of took this kid under his wing, talked about life after death. Or thereafter, I mean, what happens after you die. Also told the story of an ex-Navy SEAL that he had met at a Christmas party that he later heard or found out that had died in Benghazi during the attacks there on September 11th of this year. Then the mother of that ex-Navy SEAL actually asked Romney's campaign to stop telling that story, which was kind of an interesting point from last week. But really, it seemed like he was really trying to push the personal side, letting people in on Mitt Romney the man, at least at this short. He spoke for about 15 minutes, but that was a good half of that speech.
Mm-hmm. I know President Clinton was in the state this weekend. I think Sandhya Dirks covered that too, but he always is a big draw.
Yeah, he was here not really focusing, well, not really focusing on the presidential election. He was both at a fundraiser for Leonard Boswell here in Des Moines. It was closed to the media. But yeah, Sandhya Dirks was up covering Clinton's stop in Sioux City, where he was campaigning for Christy Vilsack, who's facing Steve King in a tight race for the newly drawn fourth district. And from what Sandhya reported, Clinton was also there talking about, it's Bill Clinton, so of course he's going to bring up everything, but he was also there talking about the presidential race.
Right. President Obama back in the state this week. He has, of course, the big second debate tomorrow night, Tuesday night. Where will he be in Iowa later this week?
Yeah, he'll be at Mount Vernon at Cornell College in eastern Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Any idea what he's expected to talk about?
Well, I'm going to make a guess. Since he's at a college, he'll be talking Pell Grants, education, what his administration can do for job growth. Also, really what the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign have been hitting hard this week is early voting in Iowa. So I know that there will be some satellite voting set up at the campus between 11 to 5. So that'll be pushed a lot as well.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we promised that musical backdrop, not only for Mitt Romney, which we heard at the beginning of this segment, but also for President Obama. Who is coming that is so musically inclined that we might want to take notice for President Obama?
Well, Bruce Springsteen's going to be back. The Boss will be in Ames later this week on Thursday. And Springsteen, he campaigned heavily with the president in the last election. He was also, along with Pearl Jam, Dave Matthews Band, and REM, were staging these concerts in swing states across the country back when George W. Bush faced John Kerry. So he's no stranger to Iowa during a campaign.
Okay. We'll go out with a little music from the Boss himself, Clay Masters. We enjoy your reporting, and thank you for talking to us for a few minutes.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. This flag is born.